Good morning and welcome to the CSP radio show here on WDRT 91.9 FM. You can find this show along with many other great archival episodes of other podcasts and radio shows on WDRT.org. My name is Joseph Childs and I'm the Agricultural Coordinator for Crawford Stewardship Project as well as your host today. Today, I'm sitting down with Amy Fenn, the Executive Director for CSP, and Vance Haugen is our guest. Vance is a retired UW Extension agricultural agent for Crawford County and one of the founding members of Great River Grazers, a grazing organization that is founded in 1993 and has been doing some great work for the past 30 years. So Vance, first off, thanks for coming down, and yeah. I really appreciate getting the opportunity to pick your brain a little bit and talk to you here on the show.
Sure.
So a life in agriculture, be it practicing or educating about it, can you give us a little bit more of a background on what you've done?
Well, absolutely. I'll give you the elevator speech. I've been in agriculture all my life. I was raised on a small, diversified farm in northern Minnesota. My dad milked 20 cows. You know, we had some beef cattle, some pigs, some chickens, all that happy stuff. And I got a degree in ag mechanization out of the ag engineering department at North Dakota State. And during those times, I bought a farm, and I was farming part-time and working full-time off the farm. And then the farm crisis hit, and the feces hit the fan, absolutely. And it was brutal. Needed some more money, so I decided that I had to get a better-paying job. And so I had to leave the farm behind, and I took a job here in Wisconsin. And that's how I got here to Wisconsin. That was over in Shawano. And I had a little farmette over there, raised some sheep and some pigs, and had a great time. And in 1988, that was the big drought that many people can remember, provided you were born after that, or before that, excuse me. There was a neighbor that was doing rotational grazing in 1988 up there by Shawano. And I got interested in it. And then I had an opportunity to move. So I moved over here to Crawford County, bought a farm across the river over in Minnesota, went back to farming with the idea that I'll keep the extension job for a couple of years and I'll farm and then I'll be a full-time farmer. Well, that didn't work out quite the way I figured, because 26 years later, I finally retired. My wife and kids ran our rotationally grazed farm over in Minnesota, which the kids are still running the farm. The wife and I are almost fully retired, though I was doing the chores this weekend, and the next couple of days, my son's up in Michigan snowmobiling with some of his buddies. But that's been the... that's been the way it's been for me, I'm here.
Well, we really appreciate having someone with, your level of experience and just your enthusiasm for grazing. And you had mentioned you had lived next to a grazer that was doing some rotational grazing and you got interested in it. What was that initial interest? What drew you to grazing?
Well, I always was interested in grazing. I actually remember reading about rotational grazing in the 70s in the Hordes Dairymen. And I've been meaning to get down to Fort Atkinson and get into the archives of the Hordes Dairymen and find that particular article. But I remember reading that article when I was a teenager on my dad's farm. We did try to do some rotational grazing, but with the poor energizers we had and the poor fencing materials, it didn't work. It didn't work very well at all. But when I was up in Shawano, we were doing grazing with some of our sheep, and my neighbor, he had sheep, and I had like 50 head of sheep, and he had like 400 head of sheep, and he was running them on 80 acres and making his winter feed and all the rest of the stuff. So I said that, and then, you know, different people can experience things differently. It took me 15 minutes of watching this, and I said, hey, this will work. I know other people, it could take them 15 years and they'd never get it. But that's the way I looked at it and I said, if he can do that, so can I.
So I guess trying to understand that, so it wasn't like a, this is the newfangled thing of like it's romantic. It's just, hey, he's got 400 head of sheep on 80 acres. That just seems to make mathematical sense. And if I'm going to try and make a go at it and farming for a living,
exactly,
that might be the way I have to go.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Joel. And that's what I was thinking. I was thinking, well, this makes economic sense. And there's nothing wrong with the romantic part of it. There's nothing wrong with the love of it and the bucolicness of all that. That's all great. But I was pragmatic, you know. By God, let's make some money with this thing. And, you know, this wasn't the first time. You know, you can go back to old Vauxson, the Frenchman. You know, he was advocating rotational grazing in the 30s. And back in the 1890s, there was a Scotsman that was advocating it. So it was nothing new. But the and part about it is a couple things. The technology changed. The New Zealanders and some other folks figured out these low-impedance electric fencers that worked really well, a lot better than the crap we used to have. Instead of using 16-gauge smooth wire, they were using high-tensile wire, which, by the way, came out of the grape industry, another thing out of Europe. So there was a lot of things that, you know, the technology really came together. And then the third thing was, hey, a lot of us had our backs to the wall. I mean, the farm crisis of the 70s, you know, if you lived through it, I mean, it just decimated everything.
So it seemed like there was a, I wouldn't say a perfect storm, but there were a lot of things that were coming together, be it good or bad. You know, the technology moving forward, that's obviously a good thing that allowed for lower cost, better technology for those farmers. But, you know, it came of a real necessity of, I can't afford to farm another way, maybe, or maybe it's...
Maybe a thing to point out is that it wasn't just grazing, but it was managed grazing. That these tools of electric fence were maybe allowing you to manage the animals differently in the pasture?
Absolutely, Amy. I mean, one of there was actually a fairly good controversy amongst the grazers, you know, whether you call it controlled grazing or managed grazing or informed grazing rather than stupid grazing or set stocking. And so absolutely, people grazed and have been grazing for millennia. That was not new. But trying to make it controlled, managed, rational, that was another word that they were using quite a bit, was more difficult. And then trying to emulate nature. And I've said this 1,000 times over the years at Pasture Walks and other things. People say, well, we want to emulate nature. And to a degree, that's correct, because they say, well, you know, the buffalo, you know, and the elk, you know, they come in great big and they ate and then they moved on. See, that was rotational grazing. And it sort of was, But what we're doing is different, because we keep all these critters in 80 acres or 160 acres or whatever. So we try to emulate some parts of the natural system. And the other things we have to do that are kind of unnatural. So it's a balancing act.
There's... You know, I've talked to a few people, not nearly as many people as you and Amy is in the grazing industry. You know, I've had some conversations, but there always seems to be like there's two camps of maybe more than two camps, but there's different camps of like this is the only way to graze, and then the other person on the other side of that is no, this is the only way to graze. When it seems like, you know, there's something in the middle. You can't have it perfectly emulate nature if you have a fence. You know, that's not going to be nature. But you also need, if you're trying to do it to make a living, that you have to give and take on both sides.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely. You hit the nail right on the head, Joe. It's a real balancing act, and it is different for all things. And I'm an amateur musician, and I play lots of different instruments, but the guitar is kind of the thing that I like a lot. Well, if you talk to some folks that really love guitar, they just cringe when you talk about flamenco guitar. Oh, it's terrible. Or gypsy guitar, or they talk about, you know, heavy metal. Hey, it's all good, but it's all different depending on what your goals are. And, you know, so there's a whole bunch of things. But the long and the short of it is, just like if we're talking guitars, you got to have the instrument. If you're talking grazing, You got to have the grass. You got to have something that's growing, because grass isn't the only thing. We can talk about that too.
I think you just hit the nail on the head that you did. Really brought me back to my memories of just going to pasture walks with the Great River Grazers, and that's the amount of times that I've heard from you or Don Boland or some of the older, more experienced grazers in the group, and it's always, it depends. You know, the younger guys like me and some of the, you know, some of the younger guys in the group, we want the answer. Like, what do I need to do? And here's what I want. Like, we want it now. And the answer is always, it depends. And it's frustrating right. when you're trying to find the answer, but when you step back and think about it, like, your farm is, it's not that far from mine. It's not that far from Crawford County, but even farms within Crawford County, it really does depend. So one answer isn't going to be the same for even your neighbor.
That's absolutely right, and it is frustrating. You know, the thing that I tell people is that, you know, a cookbook is a great thing to have, and I have several cookbooks. And if I'm going to cook something or, you know, bake something that I've never done before, I'll look at a cookbook. And I'll guarantee you, because I have several of them, I'll look at three or four different recipes, and they won't be exactly the same. Now, that's exactly right with grazing. They're not going to be exactly the same. And it just blows my mind here. You know, we've got such in we're sitting in a studio in Vernon County, and of course I worked in Crawford County, but I worked in many different counties with the Great River Grazers. But we've got one grazer that grazes stalkers, and he lets the grass grow till it's 30 or maybe even 40 inches tall before he turns his cattle in. And you know, if you talk to another grazer that has dairy cattle, he'd say, "Oh man, you know, I couldn't do that." Hey, it depends on what they're doing, and both of them are successful. However, if you were trying to make milk the way that the person that has the 40-inch height grazing, you probably wouldn't be very successful with that. So yeah, it absolutely depends on what you're going to do.
So it sounds like, Vance, you came into Crawford County with some grazing experience, and there really wasn't a lot of literature telling folks how to do this, and maybe the people that wanted to try were few and far between, and you had some people grazing beef and some people grazing dairy, which is a different science, different nutrition needs, different seasons to it. And here you are, a new extension agent in town, and how did that work, bringing people together, or what need did you see?
Yeah. Well, it sure was different, and there was no cookbook, and there was a lot less formalized information back then. However, there still was networking going on, and I'm putting together, along with another retired extension agent, we're putting together the history of the Grassworks, and which is an organization that promotes grazing in the Midwest. And one of the things that I'm struck by as we're finding all these various people that help form this organization and people that help form the Great River Grazers was the connections between them. So, for instance, one of the premier individuals that was promoting grazing in the Wisconsin Agricultural Press through the weekly ag newspapers was Joel McNair. Well, Doug Spanny, who's one of the founders of the Great River Grazers here, and he's a farmer here in Crawford County, he was good buddies with Doug. Well, and then they were good buddies with another fellow, who Don Austin, who was a good friend of, and so there was these connections, and some of it was serendipitous, obviously, but some of it was very much planned. I mean they were looking for information. And then the other thing is it can't be stressed too much, is that the farm crises, you know, of the late 1970s, early 80s, put a lot of people's back to the wall. And I believe it's apocryphal, but I think Churchill was supposedly said that, you know, the United States could be counted on doing the right thing when it was the absolute only thing that could be done. Could be true, could be false. But the point of it was, for a lot of folks, it was either try grazing or go bankrupt. Now, they might have gone bankrupt anyway. I mean, and that might have happened. And it did happen with some of the folks. But some of the folks succeeded, and they succeeded very well. But it really focused their mind. They were going to try to stay on the land.
So the thing that sticks out to me about Great River Grazers is, you know, we're sitting here listening to you talk about the wealth of knowledge and experience that you have, and you're one member of the Great River Grazers, and I can't remember how many hundreds of years of grazing experience is in that group, but it's incredible. And you know, we're talking about It Depends, and we're talking about the networking stuff, and just that mentorship, almost like apprenticeship style learning that the Great River Grazers offers is so different from some of the other things that are offered for grazing education. Not to say that they're bad, they're just a different thing. And I think that's why the Great River Grazers, that's why I'm attracted to it, and that's why I've stuck it out and go to pasture walks each year. And I think that's why that group is so, I think that's why the group is so successful and still around after 31 years or 32 years, because it's just different style of learning, and I think a more effective style of teaching people is you get people that have actually done it, and you put them in front of people that want to do it, and you can warn them about pitfalls, or you know, let them make the mistakes that they need to make, which is an important part of learning. So we want to jump back into this when I get back from this station identification. This is WDRT 91.9 FM. You're listening to the CSP Radio Show. I am your host, Joseph Childs. I'm sitting down here today with Amy Fenn, the Executive Director for Crawford Stewardship Project, as well as a Great River Grazers member, and Vance Haugen, a retired UW Extension Agricultural Agent here in Crawford County, and a founding member of the Great River Grazers Grazing Organization, founded in 1993. Over 3 decades of doing really great work for grazing education and promotion in the area. So, Vance, you know, we're talking quite a bit about Great River Grazers here. If you could just give maybe a little bit of background on the organization itself. Is it an organization? Is it a group? Is it, you know, what is it?
I heard it was founded in a church basement.
Well, that's true, Amy. So in 1993, I'd been an extension agent for about 1 year here or down in Crawford County, and there was still lots of ripples of the farm crisis going on and a lot of angst out there. The Cooley Region organic produce pool crop, and then the absolutely just embryonic Organic Valley was starting up then, and I knew all those folks, and they were screaming and scratching, trying to keep their farms and trying to keep their heads above water. And several folks, Doug Spanny was one of them that I remember, Jim Wiedeberg, and there was a host, five or six others said, you know, we're hearing about this grazing thing, and you know, we really think that this might be helping some folks out. I was an extension agent. I was getting paid, and I thought I was getting paid pretty good, though in retrospect, probably not, but that's okay. I had enough beans. But the end of it was is that, hey, if people were interested in something, I was going to try to put something together, and I thought it had a good chance of helping people. And so we called a meeting. About 30-some people showed up. They said, yeah, we're interested in grazing. Can you, looking at me as the extension agent, the guy that's getting paid, and I'll always get a kick out of folks who say, oh, you know, government can never do anything. Well, yeah, government can do some things and it can't. But one of the things, if they're paying you and it's you want to keep your job, yeah, you're trying to go out and do something good. Anyway, so I had some people that were interested in it, put together some meetings, called around, looking for ideas on how this was done, talked with some other folks, you know, around the state, and we tried something, and that was the genesis of it, and it's been going on ever since. And like you said, Joe, you know, the basic principle of the Great River Grazers is positive folks working together to help one another and not compete. Now, you might say, well, so what? Well, I say, so lots. It's because of that we've done all kinds of things over the years. The group has, we host the pasture walks. That's something, you open your farm up, you let people come and take a look at it. We've had parlor raisings where people have got together and we've raised up parlors for folks. We've had fencing raisings, or, you know, go and help people do some fencing on their farm. And so it's been trying to help one another. And, you know, you mentioned Donnie Boland. One of the things, he's one of the best grazers that we have. I mean, we have many good grazers, but I would say that he's one of the best. He attends almost every pasture walk that we have. Not everyone, but I would say 80%. And, you know, one time I remember overhearing a conversation. They said, somebody's asking Don, well, you know, why do you come to the pasture walks? You know, you do such a darn good job. You know, you don't need to come here. And Don said, I learn something every time I come to a pasture walk. And he said, and even if it's not something that I should do, I'll learn something that I shouldn't do. And it shows. But the other part of it is, it's the idea of giving back to the community and having people in the community. And I don't care what organization you belong to, you know, that's part of the thing. You know, you want to be part of a group. You want to see something that is important. And that's why, you know, I think the Great River Grazers has been able to go as long as they've been able to go.
I'm glad you brought up the word community, because what you were describing there, you know, parlor raisings and fencing, and I mean, that doesn't sound like an organization. That sounds like a community that has been built. This isn't a company or something like that. It's a, you know, you've really built a network and a community of people that are rallying around this thing that, frankly, for some people, saved their farms, and for other people, it's helped them get into farming. So it's something that is celebrated within the community that you guys have built, and I'm very glad to be a part of it. And I mean, I don't know if I could even write down all the things that I learned at pasture walks, and a lot of the time it is coming from the, you know, coming from the more experienced grazers that you do have within the group, and then other times it's just learning about what other people's issues they're facing, because my issues that I face as a grazer are often different from another person's. Mine may be land access, while another person's may be they got into a farming family and they didn't expect to be farming, but now they have the land, but they don't have the expertise. So it's perfect for us to match up and talk about those things, because everyone's got different needs.
Maybe now is a good time to talk about the format that the pasture walks take, which I think is kind of unique for the way I've seen pasture walks done in the region. That usually the host farmer, we have about one pasture walk a month, and the host farmer is tasked with coming up with a problem that they're trying to solve or something that they're doing that they think they could be doing better than they are. And Vance, do you want to talk a little bit about how you came up with that format?
Well, absolutely, Amy. And you know, as I said before, I was asked to put together this pasture walk format by the farmers. You know, I was employed by the university, so one of the things, you know, we had to make sure that it was educational. And you can do education in a whole bunch of different ways. You know, Joe was alluding to that, but came up with some sound principles and have refined them somewhat over the years, made them a little bit better. But the and part about it is, it's an educational event. And the thing that I have to be real careful on for myself is that make sure that we talk and put the expectation both to the farmer or farmers or hosting it and the farmers that are attending it, that that's what they want to come for. If you want to come for show and tell, if you want to come just for having a conversation community, if that's the only thing you want to come for, well, then don't bother to come to these pasture walks. Now, you can have those things, but we have a fairly easy format. I start out every pasture walk with, I said, okay, this is an official and sanctioned Great River Grazers pasture walk. And because of that, we are going to abide by our rules. And there are but two. And the first rule is that one person talks, because if Joe has the answer to Amy's question, but he's too busy talking to Vance, you know, no education gets done, and that's the reason why you came here. And then the other thing is that we also want you to bring various insights, observations, educational backgrounds to the fore. And that might mean that you might disagree with somebody, and that's perfectly okay. We want you to disagree, but disagree agreeably. Do not draw blood.
So it's not just an expert saying...
No, it's not an expert, which you can have. I mean, that's an educational format, and there's nothing wrong with that. But that's not what the pastor walk is. While we do have experts there, and that's one of the things I also try to tell people, is that while I have some expertise, I don't have it all. And Joe doesn't have it all, and Amy doesn't have it all. But you have things that you do know, and we want you to bring those forth and share them. But be ready to defend those ideas in the most positive way, because that can help other people. And the other part of it is it's just another set of eyes. I mean, you've probably heard it said 1,000 times. You know, you walk by something 3 times and it disappears. Well, if you're walking by your thing on your farm, you're probably not seeing it. But if Joe's on the farm, or you, Amy, are on the farm for the first time, man, you say, well, why in the devil is thus and so done? Let's say you fenced right into that ravine. Well, I guess that's what we did. Well, I wouldn't do it that way. Well, then let's talk about it. Yeah, so the format's pretty good, and we do give people a chance to communicate and to share, when one person is going to talk and the rest are going to listen, because that's the only way education can get done.
This is I loved hearing about this and how the format came to be, because I came in, two or three years ago, very, very new to the organization or to the community, and I've been grazing for most of my life, but just found out about Great River Grazers. And that was the first thing, actually the first pasture walk that I went to was at Amy's farm. And I showed up, and it actually made me realize, like, the fencing that she had, which was good fencing, it made me go back home. And like, that's when those things that I had walked by a bunch of times, that I started to see them, because it's like, oh, I just got back from this place that has great interior fencing, great exterior fencing, and like a winter water thing. Like, that's when I started to really notice, like, okay, these are some things that maybe I should be changing with my operation. So even if you don't have a pasture walk, just attending one and seeing how other people do things, and farmers are nothing if not ingenious when they come to solving problems. So it's really nice to be able to go to these and take advantage of, I mean, I don't know if you could scour the Midwest for as many experts as we have at the one pasture walk. And maybe they aren't, accredited experts, but they are absolutely experts in their field. But like you said, they don't have it all. But no, I think when you get the whole roster of Great River Grazers together, you're getting pretty close to it.
You're getting quite a few. But, you think about it, apprentices, and through centuries and centuries. I mean, that's the way it was done. You had the person that had the master craft or whatever, and then they would pass it on to the next individual. So it's a great way to get some education.
Yeah, I really appreciate you coming in and joining us here for the radio show, and just bringing some stories, some expertise, some lighthearted humor as always, and for saying the iconic Pastor Walk intro. I really enjoy that every single time. I've stolen that disagree agreeably thing multiple times for my writing, so I appreciate that.
It works, doesn't it?
Yes. So you've been listening to the CSP radio show here on WDRT 91.9 FM. This is Joe Childs. I've been sitting down here with Amy Fenn and Vance Haugen. Vance is a UW Extension, retired UW Extension agricultural agent here in Crawford County, as well as a founding member of the Great River Grazers grazing organization. Amy's our executive director here at CSP.
And to follow along with us for the second half of the show, check out the Crawford Stewardship Podcast on WDRT.org, as well as all other podcast platforms.
So, Vance, I want to talk a little bit more about the peer-to-peer part of Great River Grazers. As we've discussed, it is different than other organizations or other styles of learning, but what made you pick that? You said you kind of got into this, putting this together as part of Extension. There had to be an educational part of it. So what made you lean towards, having the participants be the teachers as well, instead of, bringing in an expert once a month or once a week whenever you had the walks, and really just having like a question answer sort of thing.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, having the top down sort of thing, you know, having the lecture, that's a good model. It can work. I mean, they did it for centuries with the apprenticeship stuff. You know, you had the master crafts person, and then you had the people that were learning and they came up. And that works. And then, you know, within the scholarship thing, having a professor or a teacher speak on a subject, that can work also. But a couple different things that were a little problematic with that is that we didn't have a lot of folks in the university system that were saying that they were, you know, grazing experts. So that made it a little difficult for me to be able to get somebody. And then the other part of it was is that, you know, people were learning and there were folks that you could obviously tell that knew what they were doing. And so it was, my idea was to bring those folks together as peers and then let them talk amongst each other and share ideas. You know, and I'd seen this work in other settings, and I thought, well, this is a good possibility.
Yeah. That's the way I learned best is not just being told how to do it, but actually doing it alongside someone that can kind of keep the guardrails up, you know, that can keep you from really messing up, but let you mess up enough, let you experiment. And that seems like whenever I go to the pasture walks, there is some, I probably wouldn't do it that way, but go ahead, see how it works. And I really appreciate that the people in the group aren't saying that the way I graze, you know, Don Bolin isn't saying everyone has to graze exactly like I do because I'm the best at it. That's not what he's saying at all. He can bring his expertise to it, but at the end he says, but it's your farm. Maybe you're onto something here, and give it a shot, and let's see how it is next year and see if it's successful. And that's something that's extremely important to keep farmers' autonomy where they can still start to experiment with things, experiment with new grass mixes, new rotations, new practices, but still have that group that can say, you know what, if you really need some help, here's what I do. Maybe try that for a while and see if that doesn't help you.
Right. And there's a wonderful, it's getting to be older now, older book called The Wisdom of the Crowds. And I'm drawing a blank right now on the author's name. But the and part about it is that it was a really interesting observation. So this author goes back and he talks about this English researcher, scientist back in the 1600s. He went to a county fair, and there was like 200 people or somebody, and they were having a sale on bulls, and they did have a scale there so they could weigh them. And he polled all the people that were there, all these experienced stock folks, and asked them, you know, to guess the weight of that bull. And then he averaged it, and then they put the bull up and they weighed it. And the average of these 200 observations, guesses, these were just guesses, it's like 2 pounds away from what the actual weight was. Now, what he was pointing out was that people have wisdom, and if you distill it and you look at it, it can be very powerful. But there's a caveat, and this is the caveat: you have to have people that actually care about the subject and know a little bit about the subject. And that's where I equate our pasture walks, is that we've got all of these folks that have all these observations, and you're going to have somebody that's going to be way off on the right of the bell curve, and you're going to have folks that are way off on the left of the bell curve. But if you get enough observations, you'll get pretty doggone close to what the answer you want or what you need is there. But the second part, and this is the part that's the hardest thing, is that those people have got to care. And that's part about having a volunteer, or a voluntary, I should say, educational event. People come to the pasture walks because they want to. They're not forced to. Mm-hmm. I don't know of anybody who's ever been forced to come. Well, maybe there's one or two. But the point is they come there because they want to, and they care about what's going on. I mean, they might have different views on how all that works together, but they care about having the right answers and giving that information to their peers. And it's just worked great.
I think that one of the ways I've learned the most at the walks has been through people telling funny stories that I don't think they're even meaning to say in an educational sense, but things that have gone wrong.
Right.
Because for me, those have been, I think, two farmers, there's a lot that's just common sense that they know, but me coming as a beginning farmer, I don't know all of that stuff. Or it almost feels like time traveling where nobody's talking about how to drive a car because it's assumed that everybody knows that. But I don't know that. And when people start telling funny stories about what they did in their car, I'm learning a whole bunch from that. Because it's not in a textbook. No expert is going to tell me that because they assume I know.
It is. And there's a whole bunch of other things. You talk about, you had coming from a non-farm background into farming. That's certainly different than what many of the folks that come in the pasture walks. But it's not the only thing. I mean, one of the things that I think has just been really kind of interesting is that, the plain people, so both the Mennonites and the Amish that come to our pasture walks or come to pasture walks, ours included, and they have a real different background. Many of them don't have formal educations. Almost none of them have formal educations. English is a second language. It gets to be really interesting on some of those things. But having said that, the peer-to-peer education can work, and you can tell that the folks that come to these pasture walks, the plain folk and the other folk, they come because they care, and they care about other people being successful. And that's one of the things that I see as being really good is that there doesn't seem to be a lot of competition. Now there can be some. And don't get me wrong. I think some competition is healthy. Some. But the my pile is bigger than your pile stuff gets to be kind of, we don't have a lot of that. And I know some folks are real careful. We do introductions. That's another thing we do at the pasture walks because we try to build a sense of community. And one of the things is we ask people, where are you, what's your name, where are you from, if you're and what you're grazing or what you hope to graze. And then, of course, we have to have an icebreaker question, which for those folks who aren't familiar with an icebreaker question, it's just some type of a question that a personal preference. Some of the simple ones is what's your favorite ice cream? What's your favorite road sign? There's lots of different things that we do. But the and part about it is that there's not a lot of competition we're going to be the best, and I have to, there's none of this zero-sum crap where, if you get something, that means I get less. I think it was Kennedy that used, the analogy that a rising tide lifts all boats equally, large and small. And I know that many times when we do the introductions, some of the people, and I've noticed this, I've taken mental notes, are very careful at not mentioning how much or what they're grazing because they're concerned about showing pride or maybe putting somebody down like, you only have 3 cows and I have 300 or I have 400 sheep or whatever. And I know for some people, but on the other hand, I try to get people to talk a little bit about that because it also helps then to understand where their grazing is coming from. Because like what you were talking about, Joe, is that, some of this stuff can work and it can work really well, but it's going to work different for the guy or gal who's got 10 sheep versus the folk, one of my neighbors who's got 1,100.
I think that's the ultimate, it depends there, because it is, from what I do, they're not my cattle, not my land. I do things a lot differently.
With your custom grazing stuff,
Then I do things a lot differently than what someone that owns 200 head of cattle is going to do. Yeah. It's a completely different ballgame because I don't get paid on how much they weigh. I get paid on making sure that they're healthy and that they're taken care of.
Right.
And the landowner has to be happy with how I'm grazing them. Yeah. Maybe I could put a little bit more weight on them if I, at the end of the season, really, just pushed them. But is the landowner going to like that? So my answers are going to be filtered through that, through my experience. And I think that's something that is always very prevalent at this, at the Great River Grazers pasture walks is, you know, this works for me, but also here's why it works for me and here's why I do it this way. And it might not work for you. I think of one at Matt Dahlberg's, the pasture walk, where, you know, a lot of people that, they're more experienced grazers, successful, and Matt was talking about, you know, getting a better stand of pasture. And, you know, a lot of it was, you know, do you hit it with Roundup, do you plow it under and reseed the whole thing? And for me, that was like, it was crazy to think that because, you know, I don't have the money to do that. And so I asked Matt, I was like, is this, like, do you have the money to do this? Are you, this something that you really, really have to have, or is it something that you want? And then he finally said, like, yeah, maybe I'll just graze it for a year or two and see how it turns out.
Like, yeah, that's right.
But both people are right. If you really want to target that and be super efficient and you have the funds to do it, that money isn't a limiting resource, absolutely, you can do things a little bit better or a little bit different. But if that is a limiting resource, like a lot of young farmers, you're going to have to attack it a different way.
That's absolutely right. And there's a whole bunch of different ways to take a look at it. And I guess for a lot of years, and I still look at it this way, it's the people that are important. And there's a lot of things I could have done in my career rather than being an extension agent. And with being an extension agent, there's a lot of different things I could have done. We were given great latitude to choose a lot of different paths. But I chose to work with people and try to help them solve problems, help them keep on the land, etc. And I'm proud of that. And one of my deepest regrets is to seeing so many people leaving the land. And I know that I'm quite a bit older than, you know, the both of you. But I've been seeing people leave the land for almost 70 years, and that's really tough. That's really tough. So it's really great to see folks coming back onto the land and trying some different things out. And grazing is one way that people can segue into some of that with the potential of actually making some money. And it doesn't have to always be about money. I mean, please don't think that I'm just a money-grubbing fool. I might be a fool, but I'm not a money-grubbing one. And the thing of it is that but you do have to pay the banker. I mean, there's no reason why you shouldn't have health insurance. There's no reason why you shouldn't be able to live in a house that, you know, you can't throw a cat through the wall any place you feel like it. All of those things, you know.
That's got to be a first one. I can't let that one go by without addressing that. That's the first time I've ever heard that, Vance.
Well, I'll tell you what. I grew up in a house that you could probably do that. So I do know that that can be done, unfortunately. And it gets damn cold in those houses. But the end part about it is that, you know, you can make some money, and if you can make some money, you can pay the banker, and maybe you can stay in the community, et cetera, et cetera. But the other part of it is that, you know, there are other reasons to do grazing, too. And I know within my, the community of extension agents, when I was in the business, you know, one of the things they talked about is, hey, you know, we're saving the resource. And, you know, we're keeping the land in one place, and it's not running down the hill into the Mississippi and then down to the Gulf of Mexico. Hey, and that's an okay thing to have as a goal. I mean, it's not what I want. It's a thing that happens because of some of the things. But I'd much rather say, well, we kept people on the land and that sort of thing. But because of that, because we are keeping the dirt from going and we're keeping the people on the land with the dirt, which is a real good thing. You know, the fish and wildlife folks now are coming around to thinking that grazing's a great thing. The DNR folks think that grazing's a great thing. Trout Unlimited, they think that's the best thing there is for their finny friends in the streams. And we've got a lot of different folks. I'm thinking of the Audubon Society, a bunch of different little birds, the Pheasants Forever, the
Ducks Unlimited,
yeah,
all the groups.
I couldn't believe it. The ducks actually need to have some type of certain ducks need to have grasslands and whatever. I was at the grazing conference, at the Grassworks grazing conference, and I went in on a session, and boy, did I learn something. And now I'll be darned if I can remember which duck species that he was talking about, seven different ones. But anyway, all of those things are great. But the greatest thing, I think, is the people. And if we can keep the people and keep communities together, that gives me a real warm feeling in my heart.
Well, I'd have to say I didn't see the conversation that was about grazing coming around to this, but I'm so glad that it did. It's because that's such a close thing that I feel CSP holds dear, is the community quality of life. Keeping these small communities vibrant and successful and a good place to live. And, a huge part of that is the natural environment that you're in and you live in, and, how your neighbors are, if you're successful and, you're not worried about the healthcare, you're not worried about the bank, you don't have to be wildly rich, but you can live a mildly worry-free life.
Absolutely.
And be successful. And, I mean, for me, growing up, I look back so fondly on the days that we lived on the farm, that the original farm that we had lived on, not the small kind of disjointed farm that our pasture's 5 minutes away or whatever. But I grew up on a small farm, and those days, in the creek and in the woods and on the tractor and with the cows, like, those are some of the fondest memories that I have. And I hope that everybody gets to do that every kid can grow up at least having those memories, maybe not having the farm to live on, but somebody within their family or their community has a farm that they can work on or just experience that life, because it is extremely fulfilling, and it's something that teaches you a lot, and you don't even know that it's teaching you until maybe 20 years later when you're like, oh yeah, that's where I learned that, because
yeah, right.
So it's I'm glad you brought that up, because that just seems to me that not a lot of people draw those connections.
It's a neat thing to me to watch the Great River Grazers. I think when I started coming to the group in 2014, that it was a bunch of old dairy guys, I call them, the usual suspects.
Which, right?
And I've seen it transform in the past. Some of those guys are still coming, but there's also new folks like me that are dabbling in sheep or more beef. And that even though the demographic of who's grazing has changed, people are still showing up for grazing, that it's the community is really centered on grazing.
That's exactly right, Amy. And that's a wonderful segue, because when we started the group in 1993, I'd say 80% of the folks were dairy farmers. And 20% were other, and the other was probably 19% beef, and there might have been one sheep person. That was the way it was. And now I think it's completely flipped around, and that means that things have changed. And to give you an idea of some of the changes, because I was a dairy guy, and we quit milking here last April, so it'll be almost a year that we've been just doing beef. But in 1970, there were 620,000 dairy farms in the United States. 620,000. Fast forward to 2023, last time I've got data for, we were less than 30,000 dairy farms. So, I mean, the magnitude of change is huge. So when Joe talks about, remembering when he was a boy, and he's a relatively young man, and you're a relatively young person, and I'm a little bit older, but things have changed. Some of it, not so good, but some of it for the better. And part of the better is that we've got folks that are interested in grazing. I think there's a lot more emphasis on working with a lot of different people. You mentioned about the old dairy guys, and it mostly was guys. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that we're still fairly heavy on the guy part of it, but we are an inclusive group, try to include women, and we're getting more, but that could be done better. We're also getting children coming along, or younger folks, they're not 18 years old, so they I guess they're technically children. But I think the point is that things are changing. There are opportunities. Grazing can be one of them to keep people in the in the land and the community, but we can't be doing it like we did it in the 1970s. And to me, the 1970s is just yesterday. But no, that is 50 some years ago. And so if we're taking a look at contract grazing, like what Joe is doing, if we take a look at some multi-species grazing, if we're looking at value added, all of those things are really great, but grazing can be a part of that, and it's going to be different. It isn't going to be old McDonald's farm, and it might be in certain cases, but that probably isn't going to be a model for all.
I remember you telling me about some paintings in the basement of the county building in Prairie du Chien, right, that depicted Crawford County centuries ago, and that this landscape may be one of the best ways to manage and steward this landscape is through grazing, that it's suited to that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the murals that Amy's referring to were some drawings that were done during the treaty talks that were held in Prairie du Chien in the 1700s with, I think, six different tribes. And I can't remember all of them. I know the Ho-Chunks were some, and the Menominee, et cetera. But they were the artist was drawing how the delegations were lined up and where the tables were and all this other stuff. But then they showed the background. And in the background, it was showing that, it wasn't just solid forest back there. It was grass savanna. And things have changed. And since European settlement, so that the large herds, the elk herds, the buffalo herds, the other herds that were grazing in this area were no longer doing it, and there was not fire. The Native Americans used fire a lot for rejuvenating the grasses, etc. Since that was all suppressed, this is relatively new growth. I mean, relatively new growth. But so a lot of this stuff would make a lot more sense if we had more grass on the land. And I do know, I go back and forth argument with some of the foresters, whether they say, well, you know, this really wasn't, or this. Just let it be said, we can certainly agree to disagree on where the exact line is drawn, where, you know, whether it was right in the middle of Crawford County or off to the one edge or whatever. But areas, this definitely was grass savanna in a lot of it, and it could be back to that again. And our European, for those of us who were, myself included, were of European extraction, you know, my ancestors came over here to Coon Valley, and those goofy buggers, they farmed straight up and down the hill because that's the way they did it in the old country. And in the old country, they didn't get 4 or 5 inch rains like they get here. And so they had to change. Unfortunately, some of them weren't too smart. And of course, some of them were my relatives that weren't too smart. And they got driven out. 30 and 40 and 50 foot gullies were eroded. And so things have changed. We're moving in the right direction. And I see a lot of really, really great things happening. And if you want to see some really nifty stuff is talk with some of the Trout Unlimited folks and the DNR folks. Our old friend Dave Vetrano, who unfortunately passed away this last winter, but he was a trout guy. He was with the DNR, trout specialist, and he loved rotational grazing. And he said, look, he said, this helps our finny friends. You know, it filters the water. It does a whole bunch of great things. So you can do good things for yourself. You can do good things for your community. You can do good things for the environment. If you got a personal finny friend, you can do something, you know, personal for your finny friend.
It seems like it's a win-win-win. Or I don't know if I counted 3 or 4 wins in there, but this was, I think fondly of my childhood, but I'm 30 years old. It's not like I'm thinking back too far, but even when I was young, you know, 20 years ago, this was just how we—it's just how we farmed. It was mind blowing to me now. Within the past, at least how I've seen it blow up in the past like 5 years, I'd say, maybe the past 10, where grazing is like the hot topic now. It's the cool kid. It's like, that's the guy that gets invited to all the parties. And like, this is just, people were doing this when I was younger. That's just how we farmed, because that's how you farmed when you had a dairy, is you let the cows out, they eat pasture. You use some of your ground to make corn silage or hay silage or winter feed. And you brought the cows in after they grazed and you milked them. And now it's like, you know, I tell my dad, I go, if you would have been, you know, farming 20 years or 10 years after you stopped, you'd be looked at as a genius right now, because you were grazing. And so, not to say it's a bad thing that it's getting its shine now, but people seem to look at it like there's this, it's like this new formula that was thought of that no one else had ever done it, or like they reinvented the wheel.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely right, Joe. And it's not just, you know, your generation. It's not just Amy's generation or my generation. And we're all of different generations. But it was even before that. I mean, you know, Voisin was talking about it in France in the 20s and 30s, you know, and they were talking about it in Scotland in the 1800s. And they were talking it in New Zealand in the 50s and 60s.
And again, to specify, managed grazing.
Managed grazing, yeah, because grazing, you know, just turning them out. If you want to go to the my ancestors came from Norway. Well, those goofy boogers, you know, they graze in the valley and then they'd send them up to the mountains, and you know, and then they'd find whatever was left, bring them back in the fall. Yeah, so they grazed, but they didn't manage or control or use a rational grazing. So,
which you really don't. My experience of knowing about raising livestock came from watching PBS growing up, mm-hmm. and you didn't see managed grazing. So
no, it takes a while, and so there's a lot of positive things going on there, and agriculture. I mean, we all need to eat, and so this is not to vilify folks that do things differently. I mean, you know, there's row cropping and there's other things, but there are more environmentally friendly and community friendly ways of getting things done. And that's where, you know, we take a look at this part of the world in the Driftless area. You know, we got a lot of folks that are trying to work on community, and whether it was back in the 70s when we had the back to landers, or the homesteaders, or the hippies, or whatever you wanted to call them. I mean, they were trying to form a sense of community and get back to the land. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, the homesteaders were, for goodness sakes, back in the 1850s, they were doing the same thing. They wanted a chunk of land. That was their whole big thing. So the end part about it is that this is a possibility that we can help folks make a living. It's good for the environment, and yeah, done right, it can be a good thing.
So bringing up the back to the land movement, I can't remember who I was discussing this with the other day, but I just get this feeling like my generation and maybe like the, you know, people in their 30s to early 40s, or maybe mid 20s to early 40s, most of my friends fall in that category. And there's people that never grew up on a farm, never had any sort of inkling of farming in their life, and even those people, like my friends, are wanting to do the same thing. If it almost feels as if there's, you know, it's a cyclical thing where there's another back to the land movement beginning now, and that seems like, because that's all I want. I want to own a piece of land and have animals, and like, but for me it's like, oh, I grew up farming, obviously I want to do that. But there's tons of my friends and their wives and their kids are getting chickens and looking at buying land and buying and putting up fence and wanting to get a goat or two or a dairy cow. It's like I really enjoy seeing that, you know, one of the themes that you've talked about throughout this interview has been things are changing. Doesn't mean it's good, doesn't mean it's bad. Things are changing. They always are, they always will. And I think that's one of the changes that is coming around with my generation, is that people really are taking notice. They understand where their food comes from is very important, and COVID obviously accelerated that. But it's almost like there's a new push of the younger generation saying, you know what, we do want to get back to raising our food and having smaller communities, and we're pushing for that. And I'm really excited to see it, and hope that, you know, we can have as much of a wave as the back to the landers did in the 70s, as far as, you know, getting a little bit more out of the city, getting out onto the land, and having small-scale communities that produce their own food.
I don't think your observation is incorrect at all, Joe. And again, I'm not quite old enough to be able to go too back to the 70s. I can remember really, really well. But the and part about it, I'll say, is that a couple observations that I've had is that the idea of land ownership and being able to grow your own food, it has a huge resonance. And I had the laugh yesterday. I was talking, an Amish neighbor was over visiting, and she's a school teacher, and one of her students was talking about how, yeah, he was going to be a trapper, and he was going to live up in a cabin, and he's going to do all this stuff. You're going to be back to the land. Well, even the Amish want to go back to the land. I thought that was pretty cool and amusing. But there's nothing wrong with that. And the other thing that I wanted to point out is that, you know, over the years when I've worked with people, you know, as an extension agent, that have come back to the land, some of the best farmers that I've worked with had zero farm background. They did have intellect, and they had desire. And that coupled with
that's
a little...
That's a dangerous combination.
Well, that coupled with tenacity, they were tremendous. And I look at it that it can give you an absolute leg up. I mean, if you've had a good mentor, whether it be a grandmother or a grandfather or an aunt or uncle or whoever or your parents that have shown you some of these ways, that's great. That's super. But it doesn't mean that should preclude you. If you've got a desire, an intellect, you can do great and wonderful things. On the other hand, I will say this too, that sometimes some of the worst teachers that you could ever have would be your relative. So yeah, be careful what you learn and where you learn it from.
That brings me to you saying that some of the best farmers you ever seen were, you know, people that didn't have farming background, and that's
right.
This just makes me think of this, and I promise it'll make sense. It makes me think of how I built my parents' house. I knew just enough to be just blindly confident that I could do it because I was just dumb enough to not know all the pitfalls and all the things where if I would have been more experienced, I would have said, I'm not doing this. I would have known what was going to happen, and I would have said no. But I was just naive enough to try and just experienced enough to get it done with many, many stumblings along the way. And that's when you're in it, it sucks, but it's a beautiful thing once you're on the other side of it. It's a beautiful thing because you have all this knowledge that you didn't have to, you know, someone didn't tell you that this was going to happen. There were issues that arose, and you found a way to get past that. And I think that's why some of the better grazers or some of the better farmers or some of the better insert profession here come from people that have a passion for it, that are interested in it, and they're just naive enough to just go all in, feet first, like your head first into it. And that's a beautiful thing.
Well, it is, and it comes back to the whole deal about that, you know, that you care about stuff, and that was like with the wisdom of the crowds. You could have all this wisdom, but if you didn't care about it, you wouldn't come up with the right solution or the right answer. So, absolutely, I think, you know, I'm not putting down anybody who's, you know. I do get a little tired of this. Well, I'm a sixth generation farmer. Okay, all right. You're a sixth generation farmer. All right. What have you done in this generation? But having said that, there is nothing wrong with having that experience and being there. But don't be one of those folks that that they're sixth generation farmers and you know they. They think they've hit a home run, but they didn't realize they were born on third base, and also one of those things.
Yeah, that's obviously with any profession you have that. But it's I like to hear from the first generation farmers that like Amy. I did an interview with her a couple weeks ago, and it was great because I had an experience that was wildly different than Amy's upbringing, but yet we were still sitting in the same room in Vernon County, working for the same organization, pushing in the same direction, and being able to hear stories like that, it really just opens your eyes of like, well, a lot of my friends spent their whole life waiting to get out of this place, and like Amy's final destination, well, so far was here, and like that was a place that she wanted to go to. So it's just funny to see that no matter where you're really coming from, you could end up in the same exact place doing the same exact thing or roughly the same thing. But just hearing those stories of people that don't have a farm background getting into farming, for me, it's like, wow, that is really brave, because if I didn't grow up on a farm and I didn't have the knowledge that was passed down to me from my parents, I really don't know how I would have found out about how to farm.
Right. It's kind of difficult to do these things without having some peers, without having some mentors, without having some heroes. And there's different farm writers you can read about, and there's folks that you might want to try to emulate, and that's all good and fine. Whatever it takes, or whatever it to make it for have you to make it, is a great thing. But I was thinking of one caveat, and I think we do have to talk about it, is because it's kind of an elephant in the room. So when I got into extension, one of the things that they had then, and they did even when I retired 30-some years later, was we had mentor agents. So an older, more established agent was a person that had a duty and responsibility. They had some specific things they were supposed to, show you the ropes on. And then just generally, they were supposed to kind of look after you, to make sure you didn't do something absolutely really stupid. And then if you had questions. And Leo Martin was one of my mentor agents. I had a couple of them. Just a little fact, the Martin, or the Martin, as they say down in Eastman, name might be familiar. And some of your listeners might remember Leo, but he grew up in Crawford County. And so he was one of my mentors. So that was kind of cool. But Leo was a philosopher, and I loved Leo. What a wonderful human being. But he had a saying, and he could be crusty. He was I can't remember if he was in the Navy or if he was in the Marines. I forget what he was in, but it doesn't matter. But one of the things he always said to just about anybody who would listen, and I wrote it down to make sure I get the quote right, is don't make your, and he would say wife, I substitute spouse, spouse and family pay for your farming habit, okay? Mm-hmm. And you got to remember that, I started in extension in 85, and then Leo had probably been in extension for about 30 years by that time. But what he was saying was, yeah, have your dreams. And your dreams, that's what can propel you. You're going to do great. You're going to wake up every day enthused about going out there and trying to do something. But if you're making your spouse and your family pay, and when he said pay, he meant it in a couple different ways. Sometimes slave labor. Sometimes making people work way too hard, making them go without. There were things that could be. So we got to be a little bit careful when we take a look at this dream. Hopefully it can be mutual dream. And if you do have a family, be a little bit careful on how you do that. I was lucky enough to have a spouse that shared some of my dreams about farming. And though there certainly were compromises and still are compromises. It's just one of those things that farming can work, and it will work. I'm pretty convinced that 30, 40 years from now, there will be farms. They may not look the same as they look even today, but there'll be farm and farmers on them.
I think that is a beautiful place to end right there. To be honest, I think that's a great way to wrap that up. And I really appreciate people that are listening here and sitting down here, listening to Vance being in the room. It's I mean, you can't see it, but I'm just leaned back in my chair, like listening to a fireside story. It's always great to talk to you, Vance. Always appreciate the knowledge and the passion, especially the passion that you bring forward to the Great River Grazers pasture walks. Just any interaction that I have with you has always been a cheerful one and a fond one for me. So I appreciate you coming in. Thank you, Amy, for stopping by as well. And thank you for listening to the CSP podcast. Bye.